Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States in this honorable court.
Welcome, counsel. We're grateful for your presence here. We have argument in number 20-50501, United Steel Paper and Forestry, et cetera, versus Jarvis Anderson and Brian Brady. We're back in our chambers and I don't have my sheet with me, but who's representing the appellants here? Mr. Van Os?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
You may proceed, sir.
Thank you and good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, and with the greatest of respect to honorable opposing counsel. It is an honor and a privilege to be at least virtually in this temple to the majesty of our system of justice, the majesty of our United States court system, and the ability to talk about the majesty of our Constitution and of our society's dedication to the rule of law. This case is before this court, appealing from a grant of summary judgment. The essential arguments on behalf of my client, the plaintiff appellants, are really that summary judgment was inappropriate because the record is replete with factual issues to be determined where credibility is to be weighed and determined by a jury, where factual disputes are to be weighed and determined by a jury. I'm not here to try to tell the court which way the jury should rule in these credibility disputes and factual disputes. I'm here to submit to the court that these—
Mr. Van Os, can you, take just a minute or maybe 2 minutes, but no more than that, to sum up your case and tell us why you have a winning case. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes, Your Honor. First, my client, Sergio Castilleja, who is now deceased, unfortunately, and who was the president of his union, one of my clients, had a very positive performance review, which was his last written performance review. In this performance review, for example, his supervisor wrote that he was an asset to the department, that he had excellent case management skills. We also have the fact that although he was discharged for alleged case management problems, as a probation officer in San Antonio, Bexar County, Texas, an adult probation officer, he was not subject to any corrective measures for his alleged case management infractions, despite his agency's progressive discipline policies and the fact that we have testimony from at least two managers by deposition and by declaration that standard practices in the agency are to first deal with a struggling performer by offering training or retraining. And then if that doesn't work, to offer and impose and assess what's called progressive discipline, starting with a verbal counseling or written counseling. We also have a chronology of events.
Okay, but yet, I mean, he was not subject to that. He'd already been through that, had he not, and they gave him zero tolerance, which, as I understand, meant they could fire him on the spot without further ado.
Your Honor, his supervisor who wrote the end of year performance review, which was his last written performance review, which said that his performance was meeting expectations. His supervisor testified in deposition that the previous disciplinary actions and performance improvement plans were not over case management. They were over other issues. So what really happened here, Your Honor, at least we believe that there is evidence from which a jury could reasonably find that what really happened here, Your Honors, is that he was not under any notice through corrective discipline or through training or through counseling or what they sometimes call coaching or disciplinary actions. He was not on any notice that his case management was jeopardizing his employment. And in fact, the written performance review that—
Let me ask, what, to your case, is there any significance to the fact that he was on the standard of zero tolerance?
Your Honor, that was for a previous incident that had occurred several years before. And it had to do with an altercation with a fellow employee. It had nothing to do with his case management skills. So we think that is a significant factor that a jury should be entitled to weigh.
What does zero tolerance mean? From your point of view, what does zero tolerance mean in connection with the discipline that was administered to him?
We respectfully seek the opportunity to argue to a jury that the zero tolerance could be reasonably interpreted to mean that there better not be any repeat of anything that was similar to or the same type of infraction, and that as time went by, his performance should improve. Now, we recognize there are opposite arguments that could be made to the jury, but we are here to respectfully submit to this honorable court that it is for the jury to weigh and consider the possible meanings and interpretations of factual actions, like this court held in the case of Mooney versus
Is the policy of zero tolerance in the personnel handbooks of the probation service?
I do not believe it is, Your Honor, but if I am incorrect, I will certainly be happy to stand corrected. But I do not believe it is, Your Honor. You see, Your Honor, and what we seek an opportunity to argue to the jury is that there was a chronology of events. The day after Mr. Castilleja was elected president of his employee association of probation officers, we have evidence that through sworn discovery testimony, we have evidence that Mr. Anderson, the defendant, the lead defendant here, approached Mr. Castilleja the day after his election as president of his employee association and said to him, "Can we start fresh? Can we start over?" Because Mr. Anderson knew that the employee association was planning what they called a no confidence vote and a petition, which they would take to the public, asking for no confidence in Mr. Anderson's leadership of the department. And that Mr. Castilleja told Mr. Anderson, "I'm sorry, Chief, I cannot retract the association's decision to move forward with that no confidence vote and petition because they've already voted to do it and I can't move back."
So, I mean, this basically this basically was the decision of the association and not the plaintiff's individual personal decision to proceed against Mr. Anderson.
As a member of the association, he supported it, but it was a group decision.
Okay.
In essence, a group decision. And what he was, we would like the opportunity to argue to a jury, Your Honor, that when Mr. Castilleja told Mr. Anderson, I have to move forward with this because the group that I have been elected to be president of has chosen to do this, I can't go backward on it. And that 7 days later, we have evidence in the discovery record. 7 days later, Mr. Anderson spoke with the immediate past president, who was also a supervisor in the department, and under Texas law, in public employment, first line supervisors can be active in unions. That's Texas state law. And that 7 days after Mr. Castilleja told Mr. Anderson, I can't back off from that because the group has voted to do it, Mr. Anderson, in a off work time telephone conversation with Ms. Sherry Simonelli, who was the immediate past president, who had told Mr. Anderson about the impending no confidence vote, Mr. Anderson told Ms. Simonelli, made some pretty aggressive, at least under our version of the evidence, which we are seeking through this appeal the opportunity to argue about to a jury.
Mr. Van Oz, let me ask you, so let's assume that the evidence at least creates a fact issue that Mr. Castilleja's union activity was factored in some way into his termination. Under our case law, though, the defendants can show, can they not, that they would have fired him regardless because of, you know, his history of disciplinary problems and other problems. And if they can prove that, you lose, regardless of whatever we think about the union side of this thing?
With the greatest of respect, Your Honor.
It's just a question.
That is the Mount Healthy v. Doyle test,
right,
from the Supreme Court. And the employer defendant's ability to show that is the second prong of a three-prong test.
Right.
The third prong is that if the defendant employer makes that showing, then the plaintiff or plaintiffs, your plaintiffs, have the right to try to show that that representation by the defendant employer is a pretext.
Right.
And here we respectfully submit to this honorable court that this is so fact-bound, so replete with factual issues, such as what's the meaning of the chronology, who said what to whom, who meant what when they said various things, what does the chronology mean? Can a jury reasonably find that the defendant appellee's representation that we would have fired him anyway is pretextual? And we've got,
I understand you can show pretext, but is it, there's summary judgment would be available if you can't create a fact issue on pretext, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That is certainly true. No doubt about that under Mount Healthy v. Doyle.
Okay.
And we would respectfully submit to this honorable court that there is evidence from which pretext could reasonably be found, such as the fact that we have discovery level evidence. We have discovery level evidence that other employees engaged in similar types of case management infractions that Mr. Castilleja was accused of, and that they were given opportunities to improve, such as the training and retraining, and such as being put on notice through the progressive disciplinary actions that their employment was in jeopardy. The last thing that Mr. Castilleja knew in writing from his supervisors was a narrative performance review that said this man is an asset to the department.
But there were some negative comments about that review as well, were there not? And about in terms of his failing to follow procedures, he was going off on his own, set up his own rules and handling cases that were before judges, and other instances in which he just simply seemed to be not following the rules. And he had been warned about that. And that's what I understood was part of the zero tolerance, is that they were trying to get him to change and follow the rules. And then whenever he was fired and he came before the appellate group to appeal his decision, they asked him specifically if he would follow the rules, and he said he would try. And that's all he did not agree to follow it. I mean, that's just the way the defendants would look at it. What do you have to say about that?
Yes, I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that these other things, such as you're not following the rules, you're not doing the good job, and so forth, these were later in the proposal to fire him. But in the last written performance review, his supervisor said that he was meeting the expectations for his employment and for his job, and that he was an asset to the department, and that he had excellent case management skills. So for all he knew, he was doing what the job required in the critical, certainly a critical aspect for a probation officer, of case management skills.
Mr. Ivanos, I believe you have some rebuttal time, so we thank you for your principal argument. Let's hear from Ms. Ardolino.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Emily Ardolino arguing on behalf of Appellees Jarvis Anderson and Brian Brady. Sergio Castilleja was fired because he grossly neglected his most basic job responsibilities as a probation officer. He violated court orders. He substituted his own judgment for that of judges, knowing that it was a violation of department policy to do so. He allowed probationers to move out of the county and go unsupervised for months, indeed over a year at a time. He repeatedly failed to advise the court of positive drug and alcohol tests and ultimately allowed DWI probationers to drive drunk in the community until they wound up arrested and jailed again. And Sergio Castilleja admits that he did all of these things. He admits that they were violations of department policy, and he admits, and court orders, and he admits that his actions put the community and the safety of probationers at risk.
What do you have to say about Mr. Vanoff's argument, though, that the last written review said that he was meeting expectations?
Well, I think Your Honor acknowledged and appropriately pointed out that that review did contain negative comments that related to Mr. Castilleja's poor performance in case management, time management, failure to follow policy. And in that review, it specifically mentions in the record on pages 916 and 918 that Mr. Castilleja failed to respond to constructive feedback, that he was failing to follow department policies. And it even mentions that he was failing to report violations to the court. So the idea that Mr. Castilleja had no warning about some of his deficiencies is just not supported by the record. Your Honor was also appropriate It was also appropriate to note that he was on zero tolerance at the time of the ultimate decision to terminate him. And the last thing I want to point out about that performance review is that the undisputed testimony from John Escalante, who was the supervisor who completed that performance review, was that at the time he completed that review, he only knew of the tip of the iceberg of some of these violations. This was before another probation officer came in and assumed Mr. Castilleja's caseload and began to identify the very serious and egregious.
Yeah, but it seems to me that maybe Mr. Van Os has a point that is you're getting now into a jury determination. You have, on the one hand, an analysis that says he's meeting expectations. That's the last written report, as I understand it, about his conduct. Then you say, well, that's not really true because he had engaged in other conduct that was subsequent to that report. Well, then that sounds like you have a fact question as to how satisfactory his performance may have been.
And to that point, John Escalante, who completed the review, was not aware of the depth and seriousness of those allegations, of those cases, of those undisputed case management issues. And he testified that had he been aware of those at the time he completed the review, he never would have put any of those positive remarks or written that Castilleja met expectations, because all of those things fell far below where probation officers aren't anticipated to be. And again, the underlying case management issues are not disputed in this case. Getting back to First Amendment and the Mount Healthy defense, that defense was created in order to ensure that decision makers, government employers, were not handicapped in how, in their discretion to manage and supervise the government functions and the employees that perform those functions on their behalves, even in cases where there may be some evidence of a motivating, a retaliatory motive in the First Amendment context. And because Mount Healthy is an affirmative defense, two things are true. First, it does not matter that there may be some evidence of a retaliatory motive. So the timeline of events, the circumstantial evidence that Mr. Vanos referred to, creating potentially an inference, while we would dispute that it creates that inference, the fact that, or whether Castilleja met his prima facie burden is not an issue in this appeal.
What is the importance in your analysis of the fact that he was on the level of zero tolerance?
Well, I think that particular aspect of the record furthers this idea that, you know, the plaintiffs are attempting to show pretext or create a fact issue by showing that the department didn't follow its progressive discipline policy. And that the fact that Sergio Castilleja was on zero tolerance at the time of the decision shows that it just wasn't accurate that he was entitled to any type of attempt at rehabilitation under that policy. So the department was not diverging from their policy.
But how long was he on zero tolerance policy from the time that he was issued that warning until he was fired? Was he under zero tolerance all that period of time?
He was, and it
looks like you tolerated a whole lot of conduct while he was zero tolerance. Looks like zero tolerance really doesn't mean much in this case.
And with respect to that, again, really the focus is that fact is relevant with respect to whether or not the department, you know, followed its own policy. The real issue here, both with the affirmative defense and also, I might add, the defense of qualified immunity that is at issue here for Jarvis Anderson's decision, which again is it is a distinct standard that and it is a question of law for the court to decide. While the facts in the facts underlying the Mount Healthy defense and the qualified immunity defense, there's significant overlap. The standards are meaningfully different. So to get to your question, it really is the egregiousness of the violations, the fact that Mr. Castilleja conceded to them. I think the clear, probably the most poignant part of the record, which again is undisputed, is for the court to focus on, is the contents of the hearing of Sergio Castilleja's appeal, where he was represented by counsel. He acknowledged that he was departing from department policy and court orders. He acknowledged that he did not have the discretion as a community, a probation officer to make those departures. The back and forth between Chief Anderson and Sergio Castilleja and his attorney at that hearing demonstrates that Sergio Castilleja found it difficult to progress from his entrenched view of that he admitted was wrong in substituting his own judgment for the judgment of judges. And nowhere in the record is there any suggestion that when you look at what those underlying case management issues were, that any other probation officer did things of that level of severity, and or that those probation officers were or were not disciplined.
I was going to ask you about that, Ms. Artolino, that the Mr. Van Oost brought up the other employees with respect to pretext. He said there are other employees who were treated differently. And so therefore, that creates a fact issue that the reasons for firing Mr. Castilleja were pretextual. Is that what you just said to me, your response to his point?
Exactly. So there are a few things to note about that argument and what the evidentiary record is that actually backs it up. So the first point is that even on an affirmative defense where the burden for the defendant is higher, in order to create a fact issue, what is a material fact issue and what is a genuine fact dispute, that standard does not change. And the plaintiff's evidence with respect to similarly situated individuals or Sherry Simonelli's declaration that the types of malfeasance that or errors that Sergio Castilleja committed were commonplace, which contradicts every other witness in the case, by the way, they just don't rise above that level of conclusory assertion. There are no similarly situated comparators, because a comparator in the employment context is more than just some employee who at one point in time did something that maybe might be similar. So point number one is nothing in the other probation officer's conduct or the audit reports that Simonelli reviewed suggests that a supervisor ever had to go into a judge and apologize for how poorly that probation officer had managed a case. And those district judges, by the way, are the judges that appoint Jarvis Anderson to run and administer the department. Not a single piece of evidence in this case suggests that any other probation officer had ever written repeatedly in the case file after a probationer had repeatedly reported using heroin or a probationer had repeatedly tested positive for alcohol, Sergio Castilleja wrote that he needed to file a violation report or file a motion to revoke. He knew what he needed to do, and he just didn't do it. And nothing in the record suggests that any other probation officer did that. And importantly, the plaintiffs assert with absolutely no basis in the record that these other probation officers, the subjects of the audit, were not disciplined. They just assert that they were not disciplined. There is no factual basis for that in, or evidence of that, whether they were or whether they weren't in the record. And for the few that they suggest were not terminated, they also don't meet the requirement for being legally valid comparators because the plaintiffs have done nothing. There's no evidence in the record showing that they were similarly situated in terms of their experience level with the department, in terms of their disciplinary history or background, or in terms of their acknowledgement that they actually did violate policy and their begrudging unwillingness or difficulties to actually remedy that. There just are no legally viable comparators. And again, you can argue, but you have to argue based on evidence. And at a summary judgment stage, the plaintiff has to argue based on evidence that is more than a scintilla, or evidence that is not merely conclusory, and evidence that meets the legal definition of a comparator. I'd also like to get back just a bit to the qualified immunity issue, which also overlaps with the official immunity issue in support of dismissal of the Texas Labor Code claim. And I want to just acknowledge that when it comes to that particular issue, it is a matter of law for the court to decide whether Jarvis Anderson was acting reasonably with respect to his discretion in terminating Sergio Castilleja for these acknowledged and egregious case management issues. The plaintiffs have, and—
You know, one thing, it seems to me that you may be avoiding, and I wonder whether, how strong it is in the case either way, is tying his discharge to protected activity. In other words, I understand that he was president of the union, and I understand that he had the conversation with the probation chief that he had and so on, but it seems to me that there's very little evidence that ties him directly to protected to specific protected activity. And you seem to have avoided that, and I am wondering whether you assume that he engaged in protected activity that is connected to his discharge. And how that connection exists.
We
hold it together.
We certainly don't assume that. And in fact, I think it is going out on a limb to presume that the plaintiffs have even made a prima facie case of First Amendment retaliation, given the vagueness in the record as to what that protected activity actually was, what Jarvis Anderson knew and when he knew it. However, we feel that the evidence instead of delving into that minutia, we feel that the evidence in this case is strong enough to support a summary judgment on the affirmative defense, and at a minimum, qualified immunity on the reasonableness prong of the qualified immunity defense, based on the undisputed nature of the case violations at issue, the information that Jarvis Anderson had about those.
Well, I mean, is your theory then on the mild healthy? Yes, he engaged in protected activity, but he would have been fired anyway. Is that your theory of the case? Or are you saying that he did not engage in protected activity and there's no connection between his termination and his alleged protected activity?
We certainly don't concede that there was protected activity or any retaliatory motive connected with his termination. However, the defendants didn't brief that issue in the issue of the prima facie case. And the court, the district court, assumed the prima facie case had been met. So I'd like to just end by reminding the court that the First Amendment doesn't create protection for employees that just fail in their basic job responsibilities. And the jurisprudence surrounding First Amendment retaliation ensures that employers can retain their ability to make the discretionary decisions that are necessary to effectively run the department, to appropriately manage employees, and to remedy situations where, just like this, where it is undisputed that a veteran probation officer knew what he needed to do, repeatedly failed to do that, and really offered nothing more than a you know, wimpy, I'll try to do better, after having a long history of a disciplinary record with the agency. Nothing in the facts of this case or First Amendment jurisprudence suggests that an employer must retain an employee like that. And so we respectfully submit that we've met the burden on Mount Healthy and also for qualified immunity.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Van Os, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You are muted, sir. You're still muted. You are still muted.
How about now? Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I apologize.
No problem. Many judges have the same problem.
The new virtual world, I guess.
Hope it goes away soon, but
I do too.
Still in it.
My honorable opposing counsel has made arguments that could be reasonably made, that she could reasonably make to a jury. But our point here is that these are arguments for the jury and not for the court, because these involve credibility disputes. These involve factual issues, such as if Mr. John Escalante, the supervisor, thought that Mr. Castilleja was not meeting the expectations of his job, why did he say in the narrative portion, why did he say on his last written annual performance appraisal that he has excellent case management skills and that he's an asset to this department and to our unit, and that he's a great help to new employees in the unit? Why did he say things like that? So later on in the deposition, he says, well, I didn't really mean those things. Well, that's, what did he really mean if he's comparing some changed deposition testimony with his own last written review? That's a credibility dispute. And a dispute and an issue of weighing evidence, that's for a jury. And with respect to the comparators, we have in the record, they are in the sealed portion of the record, but they're in the record certainly before this court. We have in the record two firing papers, two notices of firing to two other employees who were the same kind of case management officers as Mr. Castilleja, and they were fired for poor case management, but their firing notices and firing written firing decisions say on their face that they were given opportunities to improve and they did not improve. We respectfully submit to this honorable court, and we are asking for the opportunity to argue to the jury that Mr. Castilleja, the only last thing he knew from written performance appraisals and written supervisory notices, the last thing he knew in writing was that you have excellent case management skills and you're an asset to this department. Under the Haverda case, under the Mooney case, under the Copeland case, we respectfully submit to this court that these kinds of things, and with respect to the Mount Healthy burden shifting analysis, the statements that Ms. Simonelli attributes to Mr. Anderson in their phone conversations were very aggressive on Mr. Anderson's part. I'm going to go after Sergio hard. I'm going to get Sergio. Sergio better look out. Now that's tough, aggressive, mean threats. And while he says, while Anderson may say that I didn't make those kinds of threats, you have a factual dispute, which is what this court has called fodder for the jury. And with respect to the competing evidence, Ms. Simonelli, who is a manager, testified by declaration that she reviewed the audits, employee audits, of about 20 or 21 other employees, and that she found the same kinds of infractions that Mr. Castilleja was accused of, such as specifically not requiring probationers to take the court-ordered urinalysis testing, such as letting probationers continue for at least 3 months or more without reporting a probationer who was committing infractions in the conditions of his probation. I believe my time is running out, Your Honors. Have a good afternoon, and thank you very much for your courteous attention to the arguments.
You're very welcome, Mr. Van Os. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Arnolino, thank you for a well-presented argument. The case is under submission, and the court stands in recess until tomorrow morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.